Getting into item number seven, Regional Fishery Enhancement Groups, RFEGs. This is a briefing. So, Rachel, I will turn it over to you. Rachel Vasek.
Enhancement Association.
Yeah, just sit and get in front of the mic. Yeah.
Get recorded. Also, Jason Lundgren, who is with the Cascade Columbia Fisheries Enhancement Group, and Aaron Peterson, who is the Managing Director for the Regional Fishery Group Coalition. There are 14 groups around the state, and Aaron is the one person who tries to sort of herd the cats, if you will. So thank you very much for having us today. As you know, the RFEG program was created by the legislature in 1990 with the goal of establishing a mechanism to support independent nonprofit organizations to engage our own unique communities in the process of salmon recovery. So the way I see it, we have been working together to save salmon since 1990. I want to thank Department of Fish and Wildlife leadership, you, the staff, and the people that we work with on the ground in our areas tremendously, because we obviously couldn't do this alone. Because we work together over the, well, since 1990, we have released more than 80 million fish in our different areas. We've completed more than 900 fish passage projects, which have opened up habitat for about 1,200 miles of stream for salmon to utilize for spawning and rearing. We've completed over 4,000 habitat restoration projects. And I think for me, one thing that stands out is that over 3 million volunteer hours have been donated in the process. And when I think about the volunteers that I see working with our organization and with other groups around the state, I know that for each one of those hours contributed, there's an individual that has a personal investment in seeing salmon succeed and salmon thrive in our own watersheds. So I want to shift to a few snapshots from 2018. My goal is to just kind of fill you in on what we've been up to and cover the big picture. So starting in 2018 with statewide accomplishments, we were able to leverage over $10 million, 89,000 volunteer hours, which is worth almost $2 million if you're taking that in-kind match component for the volunteer rate. And contributed or completed 248 projects throughout the state. So I want to talk about what types of salmon-focused work we do. While we're individual, unique, distinct organizations, we also have four threads in common. We work to do habitat restoration, education outreach, enhancement or production in conjunction with hatcheries, and also assessments and monitoring. Because we're all unique, because we have unique communities, it's important that we have some diversity and that we're able to respond to the niches that our own communities have. We're small, we're local, we're focused on meeting the unique community needs that we have, but we work to build community in our own regions around salmon recovery. We work to be apolitical so that we can engage people throughout our communities, regardless of their own unique political beliefs. And we strive to be unifiers by bringing that community together around salmon recovery. So I want to run you through a few quick examples of what that looks like on the ground. Statewide, the RFEGs collectively released over 5 million salmon last year. And this is one example from the Hood Canal Salmon Enhancement Group. This is a 17-year-long project working within their community with three different steelhead populations to evaluate hatchery supplementation as a primary conservation strategy. An example here of monitoring efforts from the Skagit Fishery Enhancement Group. I think they do a great job of engaging their community in assisting with nearshore monitoring as well as spawner surveys throughout their region. Collectively, the RFEGs leveraged over 43,000 volunteer hours last year alone, which equated to $974,000 in in-kind contributions to support the scientific research that our organizations are doing. Education has become an increasingly big focus for the RFEGs collectively. I think it's fair to say that we believe that engaging and educating the future leaders and decision makers about salmon is an important investment. Statewide, the RFEGs taught over 25,000 students last year. In this picture, you can see an example of seventh grade students participating in the real learning, real work restoration engineering program with the North Olympic Salmon Coalition. These students learn, or they participate in Jefferson and Clallam counties in this particular program, and have place-based learning opportunities within those communities that aim to inspire the students in their future studies and educational endeavors. The RFEGs support educators all across Washington with programs that teach next-generation science standards, in many cases ahead of what the teachers are getting trained in their own schools. We strive to prevent meaningful or to prevent to provide meaningful ways for teachers to get involved. Just making sure you're awake.
Yeah. Got one that's awake still.
He just laughs all the time.
I'm glad to know that. Thank you. We lead in-class curriculum, teacher trainings, in-school and after-school programs, and field trips. We provide shovels, tools, rain gear, waders, snorkels, microscopes, all kinds of goodies, as well as trained educators to provide these students with meaningful ways to get involved outside, along streams, doing something to help improve salmon habitat and ultimately salmon themselves. I think it's fair to say that we envision a future where students have scientific literacy, a deep understanding of their natural heritage, and the motivation to recover salmon in their own watersheds. One thing that I'd like to point out is that we do a pre-program and a post-program assessment in our education programs in my watershed. Last year, we measured a 92% increase in students' knowledge about salmon, and 100% increase in students pledging to do some kind of stewardship activity to help salmon. And these are rigorous testing methods that have been taught to us and promoted through NOAA and National Fish and Wildlife in terms of the testing mechanism. But for me, it's really rewarding to see the students come in and not really have an understanding about salmon at all, except that it's a food source. And to be able to complete this with more than 92% being able to name all five of the wild Pacific salmon and to know which salmon are in their own creek by their school. That's pretty rewarding. So I don't know about you, but when I think about this kind of change rippling through our youth, I get a lot more hopeful and optimistic about seeing salmon in our future. So as you well know, roads crisscross our state and cross many of the rivers and streams. Culverts often block fish from traveling upstream. I've been told that an estimated 40,000 culverts are blocking fish migration in our state right now. Culverts can also contribute to flooding, property damage. So all of our groups work to remove fish passage barriers, including culverts that are failing. We work with agencies and with private landowners to get permission to remove culverts, work with granting agencies to obtain the funding for that, ultimately replacing outdated culverts that are blocking fish passage with new fish-friendly structures. This is one example of a culvert that is in the Chehalis Basin Fisheries Task Force area that was put in to replace two fish passage barriers, opening up 2.88 miles of habitat. And when you take one example like this and ripple that out across the state, we're opening a lot of habitat each year. So the RFEGs are focused on salmon recovery throughout the state, and the plight of resident Puget Sound orcas have caught all of our attention as they rely on both Puget Sound and Columbia River salmon. As you know, probably better than most, the Governor's Orca Task Force has identified primary challenges impacting salmon recovery, including the decreased availability of the orca's preferred prey, the Chinook, itself an endangered species. This is one example of an RFEG project to improve Chinook habitat locally here in the Michelle River, which I understand is a tributary to the Nisqually. This is a log jam placement. There are over 60 engineered log jams placed in this section of river. Ultimately, this project has taken about a decade to implement. It was identified and prioritized under the Nisqually River Chinook Recovery Plan, and the placements have been placed along several miles of habitat to improve spawning habitat, flood refuge, and increase the channel roughness, and ultimately to reconnect the side channel to the main stem for rearing. The log jams also help to create deeper pools, which decrease the water temperature, improving the habitat and the oversummering ability for these fish. Because the Michelle River suffers from low flows, these log jams are particularly important for the Chinook recovery in this particular section. And then there's riparian restoration. This is another type of habitat restoration that I think happens to be particularly well-suited to engaging our community members in riparian restoration. Last year, RFEGs across the state planted over 113,000 native trees along salmon-bearing streams and rivers. As these trees grow, they provide shade, the roots stabilize banks, both of which improve salmon habitat. As you well know, salmon need clean, cold, consistent water in order to thrive, and a healthy riparian area helps meet these goals. That said, riparian restoration takes time, as it takes years for these trees that we plant to grow. So I want to share a few pictures with you of an example in my watershed that can help you kind of walk through that when we add the element of time to some of these restoration projects. So this is a picture of Kendall Creek. This is near, actually, a DFW fish hatchery on Kendall Creek in the Nooksack River, one of my favorite places. And believe it or not, under the grass pictured here, there is a creek. So reed canary grass is invasive. It thrives in open, sunlit, wet areas. So needless to say, it's kind of a primary nemesis in our restoration world. So this picture shows the creek with reed canary grass essentially choking fish passage. And this is a picture of the same creek with the reed canary grass mechanically removed. We've added large woody debris to help define and stabilize the banks. We have clean spawning gravel and thousands of native trees planted by professional crews as well as community volunteers and elementary school students from the school that's less than a quarter mile down the road. As these trees grow and get a couple of growing seasons, they're starting to provide shade, which is the only way we have found to effectively outcompete reed canary grass on a long-term basis. And finally, after a decade of maintaining those trees until they reach the free-to-grow stage, I've included a winter picture so you can see what this mature riparian restoration project looks like. In the summertime, the shade canopy is so complete that you can't see far enough to actually see enough of the creek to be sure that it's the same creek. So I didn't want you to think that I was misleading you, so I included this winter picture. What you can see here are the same logs. They've got mossy cover now. There's a tiny bit of reed canary grass remnant in the channel, but it's just a few inches tall. It's not, doesn't, well, doesn't. We've found reed canary grass that can grow 12 feet in a growing season, and that's the kind of reed canary grass that will actually choke the channel and make it impossible for fish to swim. So ultimately, by providing shade, we're able to decrease the water temperature, increase the amount of water that we can see during the low flow months in the summer, and improve the habitat there, as well as decrease the amount of reed canary grass in the channel and further downstream. The most amazing thing about this site is every time we go out now, there are salmon in the creek at some form of their life stage. In the summer, there are juvenile salmon in this section throughout. And when I think about projects like this happening over and over all across the state, I know that we're making a difference. One project at a time, one landowner at a time, but ultimately these are adding up. Our organizations all work to maintain projects like this, often taking crews out with weed eaters in the summertime and maintaining those trees until they reach what we call a free-to-grow stage, and they're taller than the 12-foot-tall reed canary grass that would otherwise outcompete them. Other organizations have different systems for this. Our organization had crews maintaining over 6 miles of previously planted riparian projects just like this last summer. And ultimately, that investment is paying off with projects like this that are improving the habitat for salmon and the viability for salmon one project at a time. So that's just an example of what one example of riparian restoration looks like over time when we add that component. I want to shift things to Jason now to talk about another type of project, the Silverside Channel in his area.
Thank you, everybody, for having us. I really appreciate it. I want to make the point, after listening to Rachel talk about these projects, that these are your projects. You're supporting this work, and I think being in the positions that you're in, you could feel pretty removed from it, but we're here to tell you that we're reporting on the good stuff that we're doing out there, and it couldn't be done without the support of WDFW. So thank you for that. This project, if you jump over the mountains, over the Cascade Mountains, from Whatcom County to Okanagan County, this project is kind of midway up the Methow River, just downstream of Twisp, Washington. It's called the Silverside Channel Project, and it was funded by a whole collection of folks: the Salmon Recovery Funding Board, Department of Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Colville Tribe. And this project had been in the making for over a decade with acquisitions and land donations and things like that, which set us up to be able to do the actual dirt moving. One of the things that Rachel and I just want you to walk away with is that we work with a lot of people. We, as an entity, we don't have anything to offer ourselves. We have to pool resources. We have to pool landowner permission. We have to pool funding, and then all the permitting that's involved in working and dirt moving in sensitive wet areas, which are the hardest places to work, by the way. So this project that I'm highlighting today is the Silverside Channel, and it's on state fish and wildlife property. The property was actually purchased for deer overwintering habitat, but it had some really good attributes for ESA-listed fish, too. And we felt like we could make it better. The goal was basically to do that, to improve habitat for ESA-listed Upper Columbia steelhead and spring chinook. So you can see a parcel map here. These contiguous parcels took over a decade for the department to secure. I think there was some land donation as well as some purchases with grants. And then the red parcel on the right is private. And so we've essentially implemented phase one, which we consider from the WDFW property line down to the confluence of the Methow River. I'm going to focus on this lower part of Silverside Channel. This is for a later date. This is going to be phase two. Let's see. So one of the really fun things about our work is working with a bunch of scientists, and we do forensics on rivers, because in order for us to build good habitat, we have to know what was there. We have to piece that together with historical records and historical aerial photographs. So here you see a time series of channel migration for the Methow River. All of our rivers are very dynamic. You guys know this. This is a good thing about rivers. This is what creates and sustains good habitat. Rivers that are controlled are often the ones with the worst habitat, and it's the hardest thing for us to fix. When rivers are controlled between two levees, we want our rivers moving around. So in this case, the Methow River is moving around, it's migrating back and forth, and when it does that, it leaves behind good habitat typically. So if you can remember where I just showed you, we're working on the lower half of the side channel. This was the main stem of the Methow River until the 60s, when it had a big flood and it flipped over to the other side of the valley. So what it did, I'll go back and forth between these screens because I see everybody has a preferred direction to look, but what it did is it left this very wide channel. It's the channel of the Methow, and there's about 5 CFS of cold flow. So you had this perennial spring creek essentially in the floodplain, but you're spreading it out across the width of the Methow River. So you have this very shallow water that's susceptible to warming. It was not very good habitat, needless to say. So our goal was to work within that old river corridor and narrow this thing up into a spring creek. We narrowed it and deepened it and added cover and added a bunch of riparian vegetation. And so I got a couple of before pictures. You can see this. The water's about 6 inches deep, and it's overtaken with aquatic vegetation. Historically, the riparian area would close in on itself naturally, but there is so much deer browse from ungulates in the Methow Valley, as well as cattle grazing, that all the riparian was just stunted. And so part of our riparian strategy was actually to exclude ungulates, and all of a sudden you see this native vegetation just comes up like crazy. I mean, better than anybody could do planting. So we had a combination of planting and exclusion to bring the riparian back. This is a before picture. This is not ideal fish habitat. The temperature would warm up quite a bit in the summer, and salmonids would evacuate, and you were left with red-side shiners and some other types of species. This people picture gives you an idea of, you know, how many. This is sort of an example of how many people it takes to do these projects, whether it be permitting or funding or just meeting and collaborating on a design. We do have stream habitat restoration guidelines, but we literally don't have a blueprint for how to restore some of these systems. Every project is unique, and engineers have different opinions, and you could have three different designs for a project like this. So it took years of working with Department of Fish and Wildlife, habitat biologists, habitat engineers, our private engineers that we hire, to come up with something that everybody could feel good about. So this is phase one, is removing all aquatic life from the channel before we wreak havoc. And this is the largest fish removal effort I've ever been involved with. And it was very challenging because of the habitat that I described. So I don't have a bunch of construction pictures in here, but we had a lot of excavators. We had the large dirt haulers. We had a large area for dewatering our dirty water, settling ponds. And we took many of the materials on site to construct this project. One of the concerns that we heard in the community was this was one of the best waterfowl hunting sites in the Upper Mehow Basin. One of my board members, who's a fisherman and a duck hunter, was concerned that he was going to lose his waterfowl hunting site. And so we built in a series of, you know, this narrow, deep thread for fish and then this hemi marsh on the side. And I'm happy to report that he's still shooting ducks in this area. And he's happy that I can report that too. But I want to stress, you know, building, I think I could build commercial developments now because working in wetlands has got to be the most challenging place to get permits. And I think if you can build a project in the floodplain of a river like the Mehow, you could build anything. Oh, there we go. So here's a couple of panoramics climbing up on top of the excavator and looking down mid-construction. You can see, you know, you can see sort of the historic size of this channel. We're really trying to narrow that width-depth ratio. And you can see some of the planting and this white irrigation pipe, because on the east side, you're not just putting trees in the ground and walking away. You're having to irrigate them. So we're having to irrigate these plants for the first few years. This pipe eventually comes up and things take off on their own. Now, it's kind of hard for you guys to see, but Google Earth. I mean, our picture is pretty large scale. I can see it better over here, but here's before on the left and then after. So you can see the little hemi marshes along the side of the channel, and you can see how we built this narrow, sinuous channel. And we feel good about how the project looks now. It doesn't really look like humans have been involved in the landscape, which I like. A lot of our restoration projects, they're sometimes kind of ugly for a while. They're heavy-handed. This, if the average person went out there and they had never been there before, they'd probably not know that a restoration project occurred, and I like that. I feel good about it. But the only way to really validate our projects is by monitoring them. And so we take kids out, and we have biologists we work with, and we are seeing an increase in juvenile spring chinook and steelhead rearing. These chinook came from, they're living in Silver Side Channel, and so we're seeing some benefits from this project take place in the near term. We feel good about not only the aesthetics, but also the fish response so far. So that's an example of a choreographed presentation and an improvised presentation. And we feel grateful to have your time, and we want to thank you because you support our work. And that's why we're here today.
Well, thank you, Rachel. Thank you, Jason. And the commission's heard me echo it before, but I think the RFEGs are a very strong and a natural ally for the department. You guys are in the communities across the state. You're engaged with a broad communities across the state, from ag to industry to consumptive, non-consumptive, and folks. And from the educational benefits, from the restoration, from the habitat, I'm encouraged about the new funding for you in the governor's budget. You know, that's hopefully carries through. But I would encourage all of my colleagues on the commission to get engaged with your local RFEG. I mean, I've had the pleasure to work with Skagit and Nooksack, and you know, it's a great thing. So I'm a total supporter, and I think since you are across the state, for us to, as commissioners, to also get involved, because it's good access to the community. Oh, any questions? Yeah.
I just wanted to say I have the privilege of serving on my local Salmon Recovery Board, and so I see Jason regularly with presentations, and I can't say enough about how sophisticated these projects are and how much time it takes to develop them. And it's a frustration every year that we have so many great projects that may have budgets as maybe that are $40,000 and on up to $500,000. And we're always disappointed because a cutoff comes so quickly in terms of our funding. So I was very much encouraged to see in the governor's budget that there was an increase in funding for these very important projects. I have to say I was not a real fan of Habitat for a long time. I just didn't think that was the fast path to the kind of salmon recovery and steelhead recovery I wanted to see. But then we went into an era where we saw significant recovery. And when I looked at, say, the contributions of our public utility districts with alterations in their dams and overpasses for upstream and downstream passage, anyway, when you put them all together, obviously these things were making a contribution. And just driving from Wenatchee to Leavenworth, I can observe many projects right from the highway. So throughout the region, we're seeing the benefit. And I really appreciate the work that all of these sponsors that get involved, too, to make these projects work. So thanks for coming over and sharing this with us. And again, I'm encouraged to see that we're getting increased budget. That means more projects for all of us. So thank you.
Yes. Commissioner McIsaac.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And let me echo the words of our chairman here in terms of thanks. The question, and if you don't have the answer, maybe you could send it around later. You both mentioned, well, on Kendall Creek that you saw more salmon now. And on Silverside Channel, even a picture of a nice school, a little Chinook there. Do you have any quantitative before and after growing crop for the section of stream that was improved for either of those two locations? You could say yes or no. You could give the answer or send it later or whatever.
I do have some before and after quantitative data of numbers before and after construction. I actually took those slides out to keep my presentation brief, but it doesn't mean that we're going to have more fish coming back. You know, those fish might have been out in the main stem otherwise. I mean, they're validating our work in the sense that they like it there. But beyond that, you know, I don't know if you're getting to the growth and overwinter survival benefits. That's a harder question to answer.
Utilization before and after at that stage.
Yes, we do for this project.
Yeah. And for us, funding for monitoring has historically been more limited than implementation and design for projects. That said, we've been fortunate to have a private donor for the last 3 years that believes so strongly in the importance of monitoring that he has funded that. And we're starting to be able to shift from just implementation monitoring, which is, were there fish before, are there fish after, to effectiveness monitoring, which is a change over time. So my hope is that soon we'll actually have some of those longer-term numbers associated with fish. But for many of our projects, we're looking at the presence-absence. And so yes, but not to the degree that I think you're looking for.
We're putting in more and more pit tag arrays are going around the Columbia River Basin. I don't know about on the west side. But so many of our fish now are being tagged. We can measure where they're going and have that data available. Good question.
I also wanted to mention that they did give an example of fish barrier removal, and we do see many projects submitted for fish barrier removal. And so that's another thing that our local groups are doing, and which is a significant contribution of that toward that challenge that we have, which is a real priority. A benefit to that is through the governor's office and Salmon Recovery, we only need to get a 15% match now to get our projects with fish barrier removal fully funded. So that makes our dollars go a lot further. Mm-hmm. It's an indication of the high priority of these projects, and also the work that we've done in terms of discovering where the barriers are. We've done a lot of survey work, so we know where the barriers are, and then prioritize those, and we're attacking them as we have budget.
And piggyback on that, we talk a lot about the importance of engaging the local communities in what we do. So it's not Olympia telling the state what to do. It's engaging from the community base up, and that's the strength that the RFEGs are. You are community based, and the fundraising. Well, there's never enough money in our budget to do everything we need to do or should be doing. And I've witnessed firsthand the ability of RFEGs to raise local monies of large sums to do projects that we wouldn't have been able to do. So I encourage, we're going to be having a new public affairs person coming on board with the department soon, and I will encourage that person to reach out and work with you about some joint messaging that's proactive, because you are good news stories, you know, and we need to do that. We need to get that word out.
If I may, last year, for each dollar that came from Department of Fish and Wildlife to support the Regional Fishery Enhancement Group program and the individual organizations, we were able to leverage an additional $9 to support salmon recovery. So there's a big impact and a big ripple. And I think the community engagement piece is really great, and we're seeing our community members invest in salmon recovery, too, because of these opportunities.
That is actually about a direct representation of my organization's budget. Mm-hmm. About 10% of it comes from WDFW, and the rest is grants and donations.
Any further comments? Well, thanks, guys.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
Look forward to hearing more success.